Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. In today's conversation, we speak with CEO of Fedi, Obi. Obi goes through their approach in scaling Bitcoin through the use of local communities, starting with underserved populations around the globe. We hope you enjoy the episode. And as a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. Welcome to another episode of Build with Bitcoin. I'm your co-host, Israel Munoz, along with co-host Lynn Bairstow. Today, we have the pleasure of having Obi Nwosu onto the podcast. Obi, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. Of course, today's conversation will be centered around Fedi, but you have a fascinating story as an entrepreneur, what you're working on to scale Bitcoin, along with maybe some other initiatives, which if we have time, we'll hopefully touch on, Obi. But let's just maybe kickstart the story with a little bit about who you are. We like to get to know the guest a little bit as far as with their background and what the Bitcoin journey was for them. So in your case, prior to the Bitcoin exchange, even Obi, what were you working on and then how did you get into Bitcoin?
So I grew up in the UK, child of Nigerian immigrants, very hardworking, working class Nigerians instilled that into me. I studied computer science and I ended up working in the dot-com one era and the dot-com two era as a CTO, initially a developer, then CTO and chief application architect for about 15 years until I decided to work for myself. Around that time, it was 2011, I discovered Bitcoin, or actually multiple people told me about Bitcoin because one, I would always go on about inequality of opportunity in the world. And I am also a geek, through my background. I'm a true geek, like not just computers, AI. I study computer science and common science at university. I'm into anime, board games, I'm geek level 11. They saw this thing, which was technology combined with this sort of meritocratic elements. So it's meritocratic money, freedom, finance. And they thought, Obi, you've got to send it to. So two or three different people within them gone sent this to me. And I read about it. I decided to put a little bit in. And I thought it was an incredible idea. But I didn't think it would be able to have staying power. So I forgot about it for a couple of years until 2013. And still around, it was worth significantly more. It had staying power. And the fundamentals were still the same. And so I decided with my then co-founders to set up a company called CoinFlow, which was, at the time, there were a few exchanges in the UK, but they were very badly run. They would get rug pulled or they would lose people's monies. They weren't secure. They weren't reliable. So it was a very simple idea. Let's make an exchange in the UK that's secure and reliable. And we launched and over a period of nearly a decade, about 8 years, we grew at one point 70% market share in the UK. We were listed on the New York Stock Exchange in association with Wall Street for the Bitcoins and GBP currency pair. Did the whole New York hit the gavel, all that sort of stuff. We created the world's first physically delivered Bitcoin futures product and many other things. We were one of the first to be regulated in mainland Europe. But all that time, I was helping, and there's nothing wrong with this, though, is just that I was helping some of the wealthiest people in the world and organizations get wealthier. We were based in the city of London on Chancery Avenue, right next to the Gold District. I came into Bitcoin and I got excited about it for its help to some of the most disempowered communities in the world. And as time went by, I was doing less and less of that. And I tried very hard while in that organization to do that. But I realized that the very nature of what we were doing prevented us from being able to do that. So I decided to sell the company. It was profitable and it was a fine going concern, but to focus on what I really wanted to do, help some of the most disempowered communities around the world and give them access to this incredible technology. And that is what led to a very interesting story, which I can go into about how I ended up meeting my co-founder, Eric, and Fedi.
Okay, and before we get into the second part of the story, which is of course the focus for today, but for context, Obi, so you mentioned CoinFloor, you started in 2000, what was it, 13?
2013, yes,
Okay, and you ran it until you sold it in what year?
It was 2020, the December 2020, or was it early 2021? But yeah,
Okay.
it's now a different life. But yeah,
Yeah.
about 2 or 3 years ago, end of 2020, I think. Yeah, so it was around 8 years.
Okay, fascinating. So you go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah, and just as a little context, I think it'd be great to tell our audience what is Fetty on a super high level, and then we can drill back down and get into the story of it.
Oh,
But
myself.
yeah.
No problem. So if I was going to put it in a phrase, Fetty is a company that makes a community super app. It's run by and for community. So it has all of the power of something like a WeChat or what Elon Musk wants X.com to become. So you have conversation and chat in that. You have the ability to send value in the app, and you have the ability to upgrade it. WeChat has these mini apps inside that can you can tailor the experience to your needs, and this is the aspiration for X.com as well. And these apps worldwide are some of the most successful apps in existence. In fact, they obviate the need for many of the other apps on people's devices. But they are all have one Achilles heel in our mind, which is they are all highly centralized. You're one person, some stranger somewhere. Maybe it's in China or in Silicon Valley, has complete visibility control over your use of this app. And as you use it more and more for your digital life, that becomes more and more of a concern. Fetty is the first community super app, so it's the same functionality, the same experience as these, but run by and for communities. So the hard work is behind the scenes, doing a lot of technical wizardry to make the experience just the same as these, but where we have no control on what you do, you are in control, your community, the people that you care about and know you the most and care about you the most are the ones who are able to help run this to for your benefit. And we foresee a future where there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these federations, as we call them, running these services where any user can connect to multiple of them. So, because you're part of multiple communities, you're a family community where you might have less features and functionality there, but you might store more value there. Your school or church or synagogue, or it could be your village or town or company. They all can choose to create their own sentiment for their community. And so Fetty makes this app, and separately, which is a really important part of what we do, having focused on some of the most disempowered communities around the world, is Fedi has this human element. We have people on the ground in these communities, some of the most disempowered communities around the world, Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, and beyond. And they understand and care about the local community, but they also understand Fedi and Fedi Mint, all the technologies built upon Lightning and Bitcoin, and so that they can provide that decentralized genius bar for these communities as well. So if you think about Fedi being almost like a software smartphone, because it's all the app functions of a smartphone in an app. So you've dematerialized a smartphone, but then you need that support network. What made the iPhone work was the combination of the Apple stores and the genius bar, plus the easy to use app together. And that's what Fedi is.
Thank you for that, Obi. And then you've mentioned two different terms that sound a lot alike, Fetty and Fetty Mint. Can
Yes.
you just briefly describe how those two are different? Fetty is your company, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So Fedi is our company, and we make the Fedi app and provide what we call the Fedi Order, the group of people, Fedi Knights around the world to support people who are using Fedi and all the technologies that enable Fedi. Fedi is enabled by a number of technologies, freedom technologies. So one is Bitcoin. Another one is, and Bitcoin is this fundamental form of hard money, and many people will do a great job explaining that to you, I'm sure, in previous interviews and future ones. Lightning is also a key fundamental foundation technology because it allows you to send Bitcoin around at low cost and high speed, which is, again, an important enabling element. And then finally, a missing piece was FediMint, and this was invented by my co-founder. And it's the world's first e-cash protocol backed by Bitcoin. And this is another term, but e-cash is the original digital money. It precedes Bitcoin by 25 years. It was invented in the early 80s. Satoshi and many others were a big fan of this, but it had amazing properties. It's very easy to use. It scales. It's really intuitive. The problem is that it needs to be backed by some other money. And until the existence of Bitcoin, there didn't exist a decentralized money to be backed by. And so it's really come into its light now that Bitcoin exists. You can now have the eCash protocol, which allows you to scale Bitcoin within communities, send transactions quickly and privately and easily. But you can back it by the world's first hard money, which is Bitcoin.
And the protocol, Obi, was it designed as a community, let's say, community initiative? I mean, this eCash, these private transactions you speak to. So FediMint, eCash, was the design for it to be controlled by these federations, let's say?
So the first eCash, when I was first invented in 1983, was designed to be a way of banks to scale their providing of money to users. So David Chaum, who invented this idea, thought, well, banks have these bank accounts, that's way ahead of its time, but how can we make it so it's just really easy to use? And this was pre-mobile phone, so he was really thinking ahead. But it was really easy for individuals to use, buy, spend, etc., without having this massive computing load that would be needed for server farms, etc. Instead, if we could actually allow people to hold their own money, but in digital form, but it would act like cash, but you would send the money around peer-to-peer, person-to-person, then there wouldn't be this need for significant infrastructure servers for the banks, and it could scale to... well, there'd be no limits to how much you could scale. So that was the original idea. And there was a lot of interest in the idea at the time. He actually was very close to penning a deal with Microsoft where every version of the Windows 3.0 would come pre-installed with what he called DigiCash at the time. At the last moment, he decided to massively increase the amount he wanted, which is not very good from a business point of view. Inexplicably, they decided not to go ahead. And he had a history of doing that. So he kept on losing these massive deals with banks and companies because of that. And the company eventually failed. Because even though the technology is great, when you invest in working with something, it's not just the technology, it's also the business side that's important. And something that we'll come to talk about more for Fedi. Fast forward, Bitcoin was invented. And a little bit of, very interestingly, two of some of the earliest commentators on Bitcoin, Hal Finney and James Davies, when the white paper came out for Bitcoin, saw it, realized that for it to scale, you would need something like Chami and eCash on top of it. In fact, 8 days after the white paper came out, one referred that to, for this scale to billions of users, you would need something like a Chami and eCash on top of it. And then Hal Finney, a year or so later, said the same thing, that for Bitcoin to scale, you'll need this sort of concept. So it was understood very early on that that was a way for Bitcoin to scale. But still, there was a mindset around trusting one entity for holding the money. The big innovation came, I believe, although he's very modest, was from my co-founder, Eric, where he realized that Bitcoin also enables something for the first time, multiple people to simultaneously own an asset. If you think about it, there's a concept called multisig, which allows multiple people to own the keys to some money, to be able to own the money. And as long as the majority of them agree, they can spend the money. Now, you can replicate this in the traditional world with, you can have a bank vault with multiple keys to open the bank vault, or you can have multiple signatories on a bank account. But that's just replicating that concept. But actually, the money's still held in a bank. And if the bank decides to walk off with the money, it doesn't matter if you have multiple signatories or if the bank vault, yes, you have multiple keys to open it, but the bank vault is still a physical vault. Someone can, get a hammer and take out the bank vault. It's still in one location. So you have an illusion of multiple people owning it. With Bitcoin, for the first time, multiple people actually own it simultaneously. There isn't a concept of a one person can override that. And so if you combine that with eCash, you could have the actual bank that's holding the Bitcoin also be multiple people. Now, once you do that, who should these multiple people be? The next logical step should be it should be people that you know and trust. So that's where you start naturally realizing that your communities, your friends and family are people or loved ones or respected leaders in your community are people that are ideally placed to be in congregate in aggregate, people that should look after a given community or organization's money. For example, the senior leadership team of a company, probably a good place to be multiple key holders for the company because they're already responsible for that money anyway. And so that is where Fedimint came in. And it's this fundamental innovation on top of the original eCash protocol from 40 plus years ago.
Okay, interesting. And so just to maybe land some of these concepts you just went through, Obi, and you mentioned Hal Finney a little bit ago, and in these early days, it was even discussed that Bitcoin would need to scale through, I believe, what he referred to as Bitcoin banks. So this concept of, and maybe what comes to mind for most people is, a private bank. The concept we're very familiar with. We trust that our bank is going to safely hold our money, right? And what the concept you're mentioning with Fedi is you can have that same concept of safely held money, but instead of trusting private institutions, you're relying on a collaborative custody model in a way. You're a community held bank, to put it that way. How does that work, and how do I know it's safe? Where does the safekeeping come from then, Obi?
So I think one, you're perfectly right there. And two, before going into the technical detail, I try not to go into too much of the technical details. I want to step back. You mentioned a statement that most people trust their, for a private bank to hold their money. That is a quite from a global perspective, unusual perspective. Most people's experience of money globally is that banks are not necessarily, or third parties are not necessarily the most trustworthy. If you're living under the yoke of an authoritarian regime, you may have really good banking, but you just not tell trust it if you do not agree with the regime. It could be stopped at any point or put you at risk. Because if you receive money from someone who has a view that opposes that government, for example, the very act of receiving it could put you at risk. So you therefore cannot use it because it's risky for you to use it. More than half the world lives under the yoke of an authoritarian regime. Therefore, a minority of the world lives in a democracy. And that number is unfortunately decreasing. You have to be in a democracy to begin with to have that view. And then secondly, there's this another way of dividing the world with people who are unbanked, so cannot afford to have a bank, or are underbanked. And the reason why they are underbanked or unbanked is because these are private institutions and they have a profit motive. And the costs and overheads of providing banking means that some people are just not financially worthwhile to offer banking to. And again, that separate division of the world is more than half the world. You're actually a subset of a subset worldwide. And we as the company are focusing on the other 4 or 5 billion. So that's the first thing. And that's always why it's more when we're in the global south or talking to certain humanitarian human rights defenders, instant click, no question. They don't say, well, why would I not trust the bank? Because they either they don't have banking. It's really, really so terrible banking, you wouldn't call it banking. You have to physically walk into an office anytime you want to receive or to deposit money. You don't have access to online or digital banking, or they cannot trust banking, so they instantly know that. So that's the majority of the world. So going on to, and that's why the opportunity is so large, because it's sort of invisible to the West. They don't see this opportunity. And as soon as you have these people, they have the Fed order out there, we just see there's this massive opportunity. People begging for this service, really wanting it, and no one else disturbing it because they just don't see it. They're blind to it. But in terms of how you can trust, well, the number one element is understanding, well, if you cannot have banking, who can you trust? And you maybe are not technically comfortable with yourself doing yourself. What other option do you have? And then in that case, the other option is maybe a group of your peers that you, through your life experience from KYF, knowing your friends, knowing your family, have learned are trustworthy and are the knowledgeable people in your community. They're the Uncle Jim who knows how to fix something who's technical. You will know. I'll ask you a different question, and this is one of the most powerful elements. Let's say own some Bitcoin and you decide to sell custody. So you might have it on an exchange, a private enterprise, as you said. But some people, and you might, maybe not you or maybe you'll know, will sell custody somehow. Yeah. And if you sell custody, you're supposed to keep a backup of your keys, 12 words, at a high level. Now, who do you give those backups of those keys to? You're likely going to give it, without revealing, probably someone that you trust. Or either you're wealthy enough to hold it in a bank vault, but then again, you're above a certain wealth level again, or in which means you're trusting the bank. Or you'll keep it with to a friend or a family that you just know that you just know from your KYF that they'll be able to hold it. By giving them that backup, you've given them your money as well. So you implicitly trusted them with all the value you're holding there. But we do it so implicitly. We trust our friends and family on these things. And so implicitly, we don't even consciously realize it because it's just subconscious. And as a society, humanity's superpower is the ability to form complex society. And that's based on the ability to have an instinct and intuition for people we can trust or not. Without that, we would still be at the level of the animals. It's literally humans, termites, and bees are the only things that can form common society. It's on the planet. And if you see a termite mound in the Serengeti or the Masai Mara, it's incredible. We still don't understand how these things work. And termites don't have something that we call a brain. They don't have opposable thumbs. It isn't intelligence or the ability to have fine-grained control of the world that allows them to achieve this feat of engineering. It's their ability to form complex society. It is our superpower.
Interesting, this whole concept of trust, because there's trust on different levels, too. It's like, I might trust my mother because I know she'd never violate if I gave her my cash, but I know that she's not as technically competent. So there's there's a mix of levels that when you have this sort of a organization or a trust level. So who do I trust with my keys that can also understand what to do with them?
That is a incredible insight there. And that's the challenge, because there might be people like trust with my money, but you don't think they're technically capable or competent enough. And so they might lose it by accident. And that leads people to go, well, I'll trust a private institution. I don't really know them. They are effectively strangers, but I'm hoping from their adverts or the fact that they wear really nice in pinstripe suits or whatever, I use some heuristic to believe that they are probably technically competent enough. What is powerful about Freddie, and what's easy to say but hard to do, is we've done a lot of work and we continue to do all that work. So we're building something like a value database. And just like Postgres and Oracle and Microsoft SQL Server, these things took years to get better and better and better. And FediMint's been worked on for approaching 4 years now by some of the greatest engineers I've ever had the privilege to work on. And the idea is for it to be like a Rolls Royce. It's incredibly high technology, but it should just work. And it reduces the technical ability needed to be able to operate a very, very complex device, or like a Tesla, it reduces it even further in theory. So that's the key innovation with Fedimint and why we build on top of that. It's doing something very complicated, but it's simplifying it down. It's also de-risking it by federating it, splitting amongst multiple people. So if one individual may not be technically trustworthy enough, if they make a mistake or their machine goes down, let's say you have seven people in your community who are running this federation and they're each running the software. If one of them goes down, the software still continues to operate. And then it gives them a time, maybe, and they'll realize immediately it's gone down, and then they can rectify the situation and bring it back online, and there is no reduction in experience to the users. If another one goes down in this scenario of sevens, it still continues to operate. No one is affected, although users will be notified that this federation now has lost two of the guardians. You may want to move. You don't have a single point of risk, and that's how you can reduce technical lit by reducing a single point of failure. So one person making a mistake doesn't prevent everything working, and it could be recovered. So partly making the software incredibly reliable, and two, making it handle being able to continue on, keep calm and carry on, as the phrase would say in the UK, in the event of one person having an issue. And then finally, for FedE, for organizations that are using FedE, they have access to the FedE order. So if one of them has an issue, we have both in the cloud, the FedE Council, who can support people. And if necessary, at the community level, we can talk to and train community leaders so they know how to operate this system in the correct way and rectify issues. So there's three combinations. One, making the software as reliable as you possibly can be. Two, having it federated so no single issue stops it from working. And three, having a support network to be able to provide this decentralized genius bar. Therefore, you can start having people who you know are reliable using your KYF, but they don't need to be so technical. And that opens up the spectrum of people who can run these versus the sort of the rarefied group of people you trust somehow and are technically competent, which is a much smaller group.
I think FedE really is addressing one of the big issues in Bitcoin adoption, which is usability and, you know, making it easy to use. I think some people are just afraid to, you know, you hear about Bitcoin, it's a great concept, but it's like, how do I buy it? How do I store it? And then it gets intimidating to them. So having community members that can help guide you and bring you into that is really important. And then also, you know, combining it into this whole service of apps that you're describing, like the WeChat on a decentralized basis, because we all don't work in silos. I mean, we tend to work in, you know, bucket our, I mean, the convenience of Google and Gmail and everything is how that all works together. The Apple ecosystem is like, you know, the easier it becomes, the more you have that, but you do end up trusting an outside source. Getting a little bit more tactical about FedE as a company, can you describe a little bit about how FedE operates, how you generate income, how you are, you know, gaining users, or I'm sure there's a level of education that is involved with your community members. Is it really on the ground, or how do people learn about FedE, or where is FedE in the product cycle right now?
So yes, I'll start with where we are in the product cycle. So I would say that you have three phases for, well, different organizations. You, from a strategy point of view, you should have different product cycles. For us, we decided to go the VC-funded route, and we're building something that will the economics only work at scale. And so that led to our particular product cycle. For people who, I had to do a talk in front of simulcast amongst four different universities, entrepreneurial universities around the world a few months ago, and on how to build a Bitcoin startup. And my first slide was, don't build a Bitcoin startup, build a Bitcoin business. And it relates, because I'm a bit of a geek, for the approach you take. And so the approach I'm taking here won't necessarily apply if the sort of dimensions and attributes of what you want to achieve, how big you want to be, your personality are different. So in our case, massive scale, because we make, in terms of revenue, we will make revenue based on transactions. And so, but because of the communities and that we're targeting, transaction sizes are small, so we need to get to large volume. VC funded, because we want to get to that massive scale and because we want to deal with that community. And the phases we have were first investment phase. We wanted to receive, get the correct input of capital to be able to get through the next two phases. And two, we wanted to attract the best, absolute best team that we could, because that was just as key as well. And also we wanted to have the correct input of investors. As well. So it wasn't just the capital that they were able to deploy, but their philosophy, how close they were. And so we insisted that we got Bitcoin-only investors. There were investors who'd invested in other cryptocurrencies who were very good friends and wanted to invest, but I unfortunately refused politely their input, because I really wanted to send the message that this is about Bitcoin. And also there is a risk that if someone is investing in multiple cryptocurrencies, they get a mindset, a philosophical difference in mindset around purely number go up in investment, tokenization, etc. There's nothing wrong with that if that's what you want, but I don't want to be spending my time trying to build and gain adoption and instead having to debate whether we should issue an ICO. It's going to be a distraction. And even though they're well-meaning, they will reduce our opportunity to actually succeed. So that was the third space. And we passed that. We raised in about a year $21.21 million. And we had an incredible core team. It's going a little bit better than 21 million. And we have an incredible group of investors who share the mission and vision. And we're really blessed to have that. You mentioned Jeff. He's on the board. Ego Def is the lead investor. Incredible partners. As are all of our other lead investors and beyond. The second phase for us is product market fit. So in terms of pipeline, actually, maybe I'll tell you, there was a pre-phase. Before we even launched Fedi, we already had access to the pipeline. But it wasn't, I don't want to sound like a genius here, it wasn't that difficult, because no one else is focusing, or very few other people are focused on it. So you have billions of people unfocused on. I was fortunate enough to started with Alex Gladstein. I was invited to the Oslo Freedom Forum. I just sold my previous business, and I didn't need to work, basically. I was through luck and good fortune. But Alex insisted I go to the Oslo Freedom Forum. I heard the stories of some of the bravest men and women I ever had the opportunity to meet. I mean, when I think about it now, I cried at many of the stories. And I then had an opportunity to talk to them. And I realized that this was after I'd just heard of FediMint, the protocol. And I knew it was a great protocol. I was a cheerleader for it. But I had a plan to build a business around it with Eric. And I realized then that these were the ultimate community leaders. They stir the minds of men and women around the world. They galvanize communities to better themselves and empower themselves in a nonviolent way, built from a focused around love and care. And they also were connected to many other smaller communities in different regimes, different locations around the world. And so this was the market. And I was fortunate enough to have this sort of credible, strong connection initial start. Over the following years since then, I've deepen that relationship, not because of Fedi, just because I really care about these people. These are my friends. These are my new family. And so they want this product and they have very high demands, but that's what we're building for. So they are just, the only question they ask is, when is this product ready? So we have the funnel. Then so that's when I came back from Oslo Freedom Forum in 2022. And I realized, well, okay, so we had this incredible technology. We understood there was a market, but now we finally found the market and we have this object, we have this access to this market. People who could roll this out over time to millions of people individually, and there were thousands of them. And those are the missing pieces, because I won't start a new business until all the pieces are in place. Our connections in the Bitcoin space, Eric, through his long background and respected background in sort of deep technology in Bitcoin, and mine through from the commercial side. Again, this was a chance encounter, but the fact that we were both wanting to work on a product, which was a great product, and we had a market, it allowed us to raise the money for this very easy. And also our vision was ambitious, because it had to be. For it to be profitable, we had to work at aiming for hundreds of millions to billions of users, and we had technology to do it. And so, yeah, that's what allowed me to sort of focus and say we're working on Teddy.
You touched on a few points that we've come across quite a bit in this podcast, both on the investor side and on the startup side, this long-term vision, the importance of having aligned values from the start with your investors and with your team members. And I think it speaks loudly to what Bitcoin is, right? What Bitcoin introduced to the world, these fundamental principles of soundness, of low time preference, of doing things. I mean, it sounds a bit subjective, but for the right reasons, that is subjective. But I mean, to your point previously of not just growth at all costs, which is what has marginalized lots of these people, you know, these billions of people actually in our world, this model of growth at all costs and kind of just number go up, money, money, money. It's left a lot of people behind, right? So first of all, just thank you for mentioning all of the purpose behind it, because it's core to your product and it's core to what I think many of us are trying to stay truthful to while working in the space. And then you're clearly focusing on these underserved communities, unbanked. How is the engagement right now in this beta?
So I didn't tell you the phase I was in, but we're still in the product market fit phase. In terms of, we are already, even pre-launch, we've been getting feedback for, I think it's approaching a year now, and that's been iterating. So we had FedEye Alpha, which was the alpha version of the software, just worked, and it showed the vision, but it was very unreliable, and visually it's changed a lot since then. And that allowed us to put the first pioneering communities. So we're still dealing with what we would call pioneering communities and pioneering community leaders who are willing to take some mess, a little bit rough around the edges. But last year was very rough around the edges, but we had to start and we iterated. At the beginning of this year, we came out with Fedi Bravo, which is just a more positive way of saying beta. And so it's the beta version, and that came out at the Fedi Bravo at the beginning of this year. And there was a massive update to Fedi Mint, which made it significantly more reliable. It's now just sort of rock solid in terms of its reliability. We had some background now, 6 or 7 months worth of feedback. We put that into Fedi Bravo. And that's probably, if you've seen the app, the experience you see today. And we've been iterating and improving upon that. Ultimately, one day, very soon, Fedi will be ready. And then it would go from Fedi Alpha and Fedi Bravo to Fedi. Now, when I say it's ready, we'll still continue to improve. As you know, years, just like Windows or iPhone, years of improvements we can make. But then at least people can see the complete vision. And that is the point when we add on our revenue stream, which you've asked also previously, which would be whenever there's a transaction that we've helped enable within the app will take a small fee. So you would receive a fee for your Lightning payment bit, and if you have to send the money over Bitcoin on the main chain, you'll charge a fee. Whatever economic activity you performed, we'll also charge a fee. They'll be very small. It'll be fractions of a percent. And unlike things like mobile money, which have higher fees than that, but they have some sort of minimum normally. So it's not only, it might be 0.5%, which doesn't seem too light, or 1%, but there's a minimum, which could be like 20 cents. The problem is, if you're on $10 a month, your average transaction could be $1. And then that minimum means that you're charged 20%. For your wealthier and more sophisticated, who are the people you hear when you're listening to people talking about themselves using this technology, then that fee is inconsequential. They're paying the minimum. But for the people who you don't hear when you're in the rest of the people on the ground, even though the money is too expensive for them to use, because the fee is effectively regressive, it penalizes you the poorer you are. Because those will be a percentage-based thing, and because with Bitcoin, you can actually charge someone a fraction of a cent. We call it a Satoshi. One Satoshi is a small fraction of a cent. We can maintain that sort of small amount, which will be small no matter what your wealth level. So a fraction percent is small. If I'm sending you $1, it will be under 1 cent you'll be paying. No matter what your wealth level, it will always feel small to you. And that's what allows us to access these markets who want to use mobile money and the power and the convenience that gives them and the ability to protect their money and not have to hold their money in cash under their bed while they go out of their dwellings. You know, they can now hold it and move it around with them, for example, the practicality of digital money, but at an affordable price.
You know, Obi, I think you really touched on something that is what makes Bitcoin technology so different than anything that we've seen before. And I've had a VC fund in LATAM, and so a lot of the work has been done in the fintech area trying to unlock opportunities for these markets. But it's been really hard because of the profitability, because our current financial rails just impose fees on transactions. And so what you're doing is, for the first time, by using the Bitcoin as the core technology and that Bitcoin's inherent ability to process micropayments, like small, tiny amounts, that's never really been able to be unlocked before. This gives the access to the market that you're talking about, which is so huge. And I think it's been looked at many times, but no one could understand how to provide the services at a fee that made sense to the end user because of the rails.
You've hit the nail on the head. The market's there, it's obvious, but it's a bit like, we know that there are, you know, your environmental views, but just as an analogy, there are reserves of oil or gas, but they're just not economically recoverable, because although we know they're there and they're huge, the cost to get them is more than the amount you make from them. So when a technology advance comes about that reduces the cost to recover these resources, then they become accessible. And that leads to this new market being formed. And that's what Fannie Mae does. It puts this operational and technical overhead, which is normally borne by the centralized party, and we can now give it to the community. So we no longer bear that cost. And the cost is also, the technology makes that cost relatively low, so that when they take into account all the savings their community get by being digitized and having digital access services, it more than benefits the community as a whole. And that was the big sort of logical unlock for us. Now we're going to go into the next phase where we actually roll it out and start seeing how this plays out. This is the adventure and duty of entrepreneurship, and we'll make learnings along the way. Given the fundamentals of what the technology does, the fundamentals of the need, we know that if we can get the cost down below a certain amount, but the user experience stays the same, it's a strong case that we can roll this out to hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world.
It'll be great to kind of follow the story in the coming months. Obi, so
You and me both.
maybe we can have you back on, a little later on and revisit how this initial launch is going. But I mean, it really is some of the main pain points to solve to this kind of spectrum of custody that whether you're new to Bitcoin or have been in Bitcoin a few years ago, you kind of struggle with, I mean, it's either you kind of go in for it to empower yourself of not having to trust, right, these other private institutions with your money, but then self-custody back to some of the points we were talking about earlier in the episode. I mean, sometimes it's a lot of responsibility too, right? I mean, maybe I don't want to just trust myself, but then how do I do it? All these technical barriers. So the user experience that you're solving for is, I mean, it's fascinating. And how many in the rollout, Obi? I mean, how many communities are we talking about? How many countries do you plan on?
There's so many figures there that I hope I capture all the things in my response. One, in terms of the rollouts, we work with a number of communities that we already have relationships with, and we will add more who approach us, and we will sort of triage to work out if it makes sense. But in the early stage, in this sort of product market fit stage, we're not looking to sort of expand to lots of communities that we deal with one to one. We want to make sure we can focus in, concentrate, and make sure the experience of the first few is really good. Some of these communities we'll be talking about more again around the time of the launch, or that we're working with, but we won't reveal all of them. But some of them are represent a significant amount of people. I'll leave it at that. So we prefer to make sure they work for the first few, because then they can roll out to another 1,000 communities, 10,000 communities, or more over the following years. And whilst you've proven it to work for a product market fit, although the potential is billions, it will take many years to roll out to all of those users. But we start with product market fit phase, make sure we get the product right and working. The separate thing that will happen though is what we found is if you make a product which works really well for the most disempowered, the people on the planet, people who are not necessarily super technical coders, then it also works for everyone else. It's like the iPhone was designed to be an easy to use app, and anyone can use it. And use it comfortably with a little bit of training and handholding. But it doesn't stop like very sophisticated engineers also using the iPhone. And in fact, it's a great experience for them as well. If you decide to focus on the most sophisticated people first, though, you are limited to that forever. And so separately, we're going to provide a series of tools and documentation and services and for people so that anyone anywhere in the world will be able to download it. And that we sort of leave to the Cambrian explosion and see what happens. If we notice certain communities in certain areas that we haven't started to focus on specifically are using it and gaining traction, we will also then divert some resources towards exploring that and letting that organically grow even faster. So that's the area where you might see just life that we are not controlling other than by making it available. But on the ground, where 70-80% of our focus is on humanitarian and human rights communities, and initially in this space, on the first few of those. And they represent, I will not give the exact numbers, but many, just the groups that we're dealing with, communities at whole, many millions of people by itself. So we have these two tacks, the really deep focus on the ones that we already know and care about, and have the really deep relationships with, and then making a series of tools and services and that people can download the app themselves and just run on it.
Obi, listening to you talk, it's clear that you have the experience as a founder who's rolled out products and companies before, that you have a vision, but you also have the flexibility to go where the market tells you to go. And I just want to take a step back and just talk about you and Eric as co-founders. Eric being extremely technical and, you know, really bringing that. I've listened to him speak and I know he's just a genius in cryptography. And so I'd love to just hear a little bit more about the dynamic of an extremely technical co-founder who's brought this amazing technology, you know, enabled it to work. And then you as a successful entrepreneur multiple times that understand the vision and what it takes to have a successful business out of a groundbreaking technology.
So, yeah, thank you. So I'm really blessed to have met Eric. I think it was in the last few days of selling my previous company. And it was a complicated company at that point. We had offshore entities in multiple countries and some regulated in different jurisdictions. It took about a year to set up a company just to realize it can take many years to sell it. You have the announcement, but then there's another year, several years afterwards of the actual developments. Just warning anybody who's setting up a business, just be aware of that. But I'd done the big part of it at that point. And I decided to go to an event in Prague called Hackers Congress, Paranelli Police, which has got some of the world's best engineers, cyberpunks and hackers and really interesting people. And I wanted to go for many years, but as the CEO of a regulated financial institution in the city of London, it's not a good look to go to Hackers Congress. Even though these are all sort of white hat hackers, it's still just, you have to explain it to the regulators and so on. Why are you going to Hackers Congress?
It was your vacation, you know? Your reward.
Finally, I'm selling the company. I can finally go to Hackers Congress. Like, I can sort of like, flex my geek muscle again. And I went, and it was mind-blowing, met some amazing people. And I was also discussing ways in which you can get people top exchanges, you know, and ideas around that. I had some ideas, and I talked to several people around it. And then just by pure accident, I met Eric. We were both standing outside of Paranelli Police, where Hackers Congress takes place, talking to different people in a group, and then we just started talking to each other. And started chatting. I mentioned some of my ideas, and he very politely and in an incredibly articulate and surgical manner explained why the ideas wouldn't work. And I was like, okay, well, I'm forever appreciative to this day. So they're like, I thought about it, and I go, you're right. Those are very good reasons. Okay, this is not going to work. What are you working on? And he explained Fedimint, and he thought it was just a really interesting technology that he thought you should bring into the world that would take this ETH protocol, which is so much mythology in cypherpunk circles, but federating it, reducing the risk even further. And when he explained it to me and I got it, I was like, well, this is the solution to the thing I was looking for. And he's like, oh, yeah. He wasn't really thinking about it that way. He was just like, this is an incredible technology, and I wanted to see it exist, and no one's working on it, and I also wanted to make it better. And that's why he was doing it. And I realized that he literally created the solution I was looking for. And so I then became famous biggest cheerleader. But I think, you know, my background was, I did study computer science and cognitive science in university. I was a developer, then an engineer, and then a CTO many years ago, over a decade ago. So I wouldn't write code in anger anymore. But I do think having that sort of engineering, that engineering sensibility helped in being able to act as this sort of bridge between Eric, who is actually very capable of being able to be very articulate to a non-technical audience, but his natural way would be far more technical, and then me, who has this commercial side from the last decade and a half, probably 2 decades, but the last decade and a half, but has had that technical sensibility, and that helped in the dynamic. But the key things that helped, and this was actually, it was implicit, but it was made explicit by a suggestion by Jeff in his role as board member. He suggested that we do this quarterly exercise called the One Page Plan. And I think that's been incredibly productive for us as a company. And the idea is it's one page, but it's slightly more. I actually really see it in a page, but it starts with a really high level. What are your core beliefs and what's your core vision? It goes down and down and down through to finally you get into what do you want to do? What's your big, hairy, audacious goal over 5+ years, then 3, then 1 year, and then finally what you're doing over the next 3 months. And then every 3 months you review this, but you always view it in the context of start from your beliefs and go down. And it reminds you of why you're doing, who are you as people? Beliefs is even more fundamental than what is the company. It's like, this is you as a person. Understand yourself and your drivers, because if something you're asked to do is doesn't your drivers, you're always going to be in conflict or stress, or it won't make sense. You won't be able to use your intuition. So it turns out that my drivers and Eric's are basically aligned, and we call it now, we keep reviewing it and getting more and more nuance, but we have an acronym, FITECHA, F-I-T-E-C-H-A. So we both believe in freedom. We both believe, and that's freedom for everybody, everywhere. We both believe in integrity really strongly. We both believe in trust. We both believe in empathy, community, obviously, and humility. He's an incredibly humble person. And finally, which is why many things that he's come up with, he doesn't take credit for. Even when others claim, he will not take credit for. And then finally, we believe in anti-fragility, which is an incredible property of Bitcoin. People confuse anti-fragility with toughness or sturdiness, but fragility is when you're attacked or damaged, you get weaker. Sturdiness or toughness is when you're attacked or damaged, you stay the same. And anti-fragility is when you're attacked or damaged, you get better, you get stronger. And Eric single-handedly works on this Fedimint protocol by himself, received many setbacks, but just kept working on it. So when I met him and he got it to the point where it was actually this functioning thing, and in fact, only a few months later, and I think it was the 3rd of October 2021, about a year later, he did the first eCash backed by Bitcoin transaction. In fact, I see that this was someone who believed in anti-fragility. We had those principles. And then the next level after that was, okay, what is your vision for the world? And our vision is that we want to disempower communities around the world. And separately, we want to live in a world that is empowered. That's a selfish ambition, but we want to live in a world where we want to see that world that come about us up, and we want to help make it happen, and we want to live in that world. And so we're aligned on that, on those fundamental things. And that's why I think it's worked so well as a relationship.
Build the future you want to see, right? I think that's what Jeff has mentioned in the past, and it sounds like that's what you're doing.
That's basically saying exactly what I said, but using a keywords instead of like rambling on for 10 minutes.
No, I mean, we've really enjoyed this conversation, Obi, truly. I mean, I think we've been able to steer clear of some of the technicalities behind how Fedi works, but you've done a great job explaining the why and the who is being served, you know.
And if you go to fedimint.org, you can go, it's really, Pete Wynn put this together as the labor of love. It's a really great site, community-generated site, which goes through, still explains it in very easily digestible form, but can go into more detail if you wish, if you want to understand Fedimint and Fedi as well, if you want to understand that. But for this conversation, I think it makes sense to more focus on the why and the philosophy, and I really enjoyed it.
Great. And I, you know, and Obi, we'd love to have you back in the future and just follow the traction of Fedi once you roll out to more. I think it's just, I mean, and I have to stop and say that Fedi is the company that's probably talked about more in the Bitcoin space in terms of the potential and the promise and the vision. I mean, you are a guest on many Bitcoin podcasts, and I think for those outside of the core Bitcoin community ecosystem, more in traditional finance or VC or entrepreneurship, you know, I think your story is really inspiring. And it's also a way, I think, for other entrepreneurs to take a look at the Fedimint protocol and see where there are other opportunities to build or to become a member. I think you're growing your team also. Is that correct, OB? So,
yes,
you know, take
yes.
a look at open opportunities inside
Slowly
of Fetty.
Slowly, carefully, we are, but we want to, if people share those beliefs and mission and vision don't scare you, but excite you, and you believe that you're aligned, that's the starting block, then you should come and talk.
Yeah.
What areas are those open roles in at this moment, by the way, Obi?
So we are going to carefully hire in the product and technology space area. There's a few people, a few areas that we're looking there. That's the bulk right now. I think that, but we will keep an eye on the site for other roles as well.
And I think that, you know, underlying the whole conversation, starting with Jeff, who introduced us to or suggested that we focus, you know, we have you as a guest on our show, which we certainly had you on our radar. But Israel and I talk often amongst ourselves, and it excites us to see just the actual, I love this Fiteka. I'm going to be thinking about that a lot because it does embody so much of what we see that's going on in the Bitcoin ecosystem in terms of entrepreneurship and investment. I mean, the investors have the empathy toward the startup founders. I think it reverts venture capital back to where it was early on. And I think the builders that are building in this space, to Cantilever's point, really have a seriousness about really contributing to a big change in the world and making the world a better place. So we really enjoyed
and
this conversation.
I think it'll be interesting to just hear. I want to follow more of your interviews in the coming months. But it'd be interesting to hear other entrepreneurs, because you don't have to have those exact same minds to build a very successful company. It's just that whatever it is, you want to be consistent and true to yourself. And it'd be interesting to see what others' core beliefs are and their core vision. Because I think once you share those, it will allow you to see why they decided on the business that they decided. And it, things become make a lot more sense when you understand someone's core beliefs.
Yeah, well, I mean, Obi, I think this is a great place to maybe, you know, wrap up the conversation. We very much look forward to the launch.
So do I.
We'll be in tune and in touch. Wishing much success in the meantime. And thanks again for coming on, Obi. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.